All right, we're continuing with our study of Mark's Gospel. This is Mark chapter 2, verse 13. Mark chapter 2, verse 13. He went out again. So he went out. This is from Capernaum, Capernaum. He was there. Remember, he was, now Matthew's Gospel gives us a little more information than Mark does here, but just sticking with Mark. After he calls the disciples, he goes to Capernaum, and he stays in Peter's house, and he heals and exercises, and we're reading these stories here in chapter 2. And in chapter 2, verse 1 through 12, we just heard about the healing of the paralytic in Peter's house. And Peter notes the fact that his roof got ripped off. That's that personal little note. You can see Peter's signature on the text or on the story, right? Only Peter would remember as he's telling the story, oh, and by the way, they ripped my roof off. Matthew and Luke don't tell you so much detail in that regard. Okay, so chapter 2, verse 13. He went out again beside the sea. So he leaves Capernaum. Now, the sea from there is not far. You can walk out of Peter's front door, go around the building, and throw a rock and hit the water. It's not far. So he went out to the sea, and all the crowd gathered about him, and he taught them. And as he passed on, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me," and he rose and followed him. Okay, so the tax office, the tax booth. This is Levi, also known as Matthew. Okay, so I think I drew for you the layout of the city of Capernaum at one of the previous studies. Maybe it was last week, I can't recall. But in a nutshell, the city is on the edge of the Sea of Galilee. So there's the Sea of Galilee. Okay, the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. And then you have, we'll say, the city, approximately about like that. And then the synagogue is on the northern side of the city. Okay, and then we'll put Peter's house. Peter's house is just to the south of the synagogue. Okay, there it is. And again, as I mentioned before, you could throw a rock from one to the other and hit it. They're not very far. This is not a big place. Don't think of Los Angeles, okay? This is, by modern standards, this isn't even a village, okay? It's a gathering of houses. This is not very big. And then Peter's house was, as I mentioned to you before, it's along the beach. The fishermen had houses along the beach. The farmers, those who farmed the barley and the grain on the hillsides up above, in this area, up above, this is all hilly, goes up above there, those would be the guys, they'd be living on the outskirts on the northern side, okay? All right, so he goes out to the sea, and it says he finds Levi, or Matthew, in Matthew's gospel, we get his name, Matthew, also called Levi, who's a tax collector, and Levi's booth, Matthew's booth, would have been right here. And then there's the main street of the city, goes right through in front of Peter's house. And when people came in, this is a major trade route. When people are coming in from all over the Northwest Fertile Crescent, they're going to come from anywhere from modern day Iraq, Iran, any of that area, Eastern Turkey, all of that, they're all going to be coming down this trade route and passing across the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, headed over and then down the western side as they head now down eventually into Egypt. This is for in California terminology, this is the I-5 of traffic, okay? This is a major trade route. And so the Romans had a tax booth at the entrance to the city. Anyone coming into that city, and they probably had one on the other side as well, I don't know, coming in or out of that city had to come by the tax booth to deal with the tax collector and determine how much he owed for what he was trying to bring in or out of the region, okay? Especially the fishermen with their fish, buying and selling the stuff. Okay, so that's Matthew the tax collector. As he sat at table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were sitting with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners." Okay, so a couple of very interesting things to note here. First of all, a tax collector. What was a tax collector? I don't know what your vision of a modern tax collector is. If you're thinking of the IRS, you may be irritated. I don't know. However, don't think of the IRS. Something else. The tax collector was a local individual that the Romans would hire from the city, from that village, that city. He had to be someone local because he had to know who everybody was, how many kids they had, how much land they had, what their job was, everything. And then he was required to collect a certain amount of tax from that village. And he was the one who determined how much came from this guy and how much came from that guy. Because when the Roman soldiers appeared 1 year later, they were going to want a certain amount of money. Let's say, 200 shekels or whatever. They're going to want that amount. And that tax collector is required to have 200 shekels when the Roman soldiers show up 1 year later. But how he gets that 200 shekels is completely up to him. He can gather so much from one guy and maybe a little less from that guy. He can do whatever he wants. He's supposed to gather. Ideally, you'd expect he's going to gather from one who is wealthy a little more and one who is poor a little less. But the tax collector was on his own as to how he was to do all these things. And then furthermore, the tax collector made his money by overtaxing. Anything above that 200 shekels or whatever they were requiring for that village was his to keep. That was his income for the year. So the tax collector, his collecting from his own people more than the Roman Empire was requiring, as much as he wanted above it, as much as he could squeeze out of the people, that was his income. His family, his house, his clothing, everything was dependent upon squeezing the people for more than the pagan Roman Empire was requiring. That was his income. Now imagine you're his neighbor. You think you like this guy? Not a chance, okay? He's a sellout. He's a slimy sellout to the pagan Roman Empire. You're a Jew. You live in the village, and he comes knocking. Okay? You think you like this guy? You're going to invite him in for dinner? Not a chance. He's a pagan, slimy, tax-collecting, stealing sellout. You hate the guy, okay? And he deals in money having to do with the Roman Empire, and he deals directly with the Roman Empire. He's as unclean as you can imagine. He's a sinner, okay? Tax collectors and sinners, same lot. Tax collectors and Gentiles, same lot. In Matthew's gospel, if this happens and so-and-so doesn't listen to you, treat him like a tax collector or a Gentile. You see that? So that's in Matthew's gospel. Here in Mark, a tax collector or a sinner, okay? There's one of the differences of Matthew and Mark's gospel too, as we'll talk about more of that later. Okay, so now he says, this is in verse 15, he sits down to have a meal with these individuals. He sat at table in his house. This is Matthew the tax collector's house. And other tax collectors have come. Yikes! And sinners! Can you imagine a Pharisee seeing this? What is this guy? What's he doing? He's dealing with the slimy, low-life, worst imaginable people. What is he doing? What is this rabbi thinking? Well, the clue to all of this is verse 14. And as he passed on, he saw Levi the son, and he said, "Follow me." And he rose and followed him. Okay? So we're not going to see Matthew at his tax collecting booth again. There's quite a difference between how Jesus calls his fishermen disciples and how he calls a tax collector. The fishermen he calls, "Follow me." They leave their boats and follow him. In the next episode, they're in their boats again. And Jesus is saying, "Get in the boat. Let's go. Hey, I want to get in the boat." They have their boats. They don't abandon their fishing industry. But their fishing industry in Jesus' call to follow him is transformed into the ministry of Jesus. So the boats are now not simply to catch fish, make money, but the boats are now being used to ferry Jesus from one place to another, and along the way, catch fish here and there and feed the family and the crowds that are gathering. So the boats have been transformed no longer as Peter and Andrew and James and John's fishing boats, but as Jesus' boats. It's Jesus' fishing ministry now. The house of Peter and Andrew, these are now houses where Jesus will be with the crowds. They're not just Peter's house or Andrew's house. Peter's family is no longer just Peter's family, but his family and his house is now Jesus' family and house, transformed. But there's a stark difference between that calling and the calling of Matthew here. Matthew is not going to go back to his tax booth. He will now stick with Jesus in the boat. He completely walks away from his tax collecting because his tax collecting was a sinful activity. And so Jesus calls this individual. He walks up to this man in the midst of his sin, sitting there at his tax booth. And he says, "You, follow me." What does Matthew do? He gets up and follows Jesus, abandons his tax booth and his entire tax collecting career. Okay, so there's quite a difference between how the fishermen follow Jesus and how Matthew follows Jesus. One is being called from a good activity, that is fishing, nothing wrong with that, nice honorable trade. And in fact, their skills and their brute strength of throwing those nets into the water, all of that is going to be used by Jesus in the ministry. These are tough guys, these fishermen. And they're going to be used by Jesus, these fishermen, to be the apostles, that is those who are sent out to spread the gospel. They're going to cast their nets, and it's going to take a lot more strength than picking up a water-soaked net and throwing it into the water, 50 pounds, picked up, thrown in, 50 pounds over and over all day long. That's a lot of work. They're going to get a lot more work when they have to go out and do this as they become fishers of men. Now, Matthew, though, is different. Matthew is in a sinful world, a sinful life, a sinful activity, and Jesus walks up to him in the midst of his sin and says, "You follow me." And Matthew gets up and follows. And now that's what's going on in the next episode. Look at this. Jesus is now in Matthew's house, a former tax collector. And the former tax collector has called all his buddies to come to dinner so that they can become like what he now is, a disciple of Jesus and no longer a sinner or a tax collector. That's context. That's what's going on. But the Pharisees see this, and they think Jesus is just hanging out with sinners and tax collectors just to hang out, mingle with them. That's not what's going on here. Jesus does go walk up to a harlot or to a tax collector or a sinner and say, "Hey, you, follow me." And then he expects them to follow him out of the dirt, out of the ditch, out of the slime, out of the mud to cleanliness. And this is what Matthew does. And then Matthew immediately calls his friends and any sinners he knows to come to dinner to meet Jesus, who has saved Matthew from this. That's the context of what's going on. The Pharisees, they criticize Jesus. And so Jesus says, look, I came to help those in need. Look what he says here. This is verse 17. When Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, this is a Semitic way of speaking. You get this a lot of places in the New Testament. A lot of times people will be confused, as if somehow Jesus had no interest in calling righteous Jews. No, he was just calling the sinners, leave the righteous Jews alone. That's not what he's doing here. I came not to call righteous, but the sinners. You'll get this in 1 Corinthians. Paul says, he sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel. That is, first and foremost, to preach the gospel. Secondarily, to baptize. Jesus came first and foremost to call sinners. Secondarily, as a result, in the Protestant law, the righteous as well, those who were keeping the law of Moses, right? The Pharisees. Okay? The Pharisee is not far from the kingdom of God. He's trying to keep the law as best as he can. The tax collector is on the edge of a cliff about ready to die. So Jesus goes to those who are most in need first, and then he deals with those who are less in need. My brother, one of my older brothers, is a paramedic, and one time he was out late at night, and he came around a corner, and he saw a head-on collision. It had just taken place out in the middle of nowhere, out in the mountains. Well, he's a paramedic, so he jumped out of his car and rushed up to the car that was the most damaged and looked in, and the guy didn't look like he was going to make it. So he ran over to the next car, and he saw there was a couple in the other car, and they were in pretty good condition. He said, how are you doing? Well, we're okay, a little bumped up, but we're okay. They're talking, no blood, nothing. So he said, well, you stay here and hold on until the police get here in the ambulance. I'm going to go help the other guy. So he immediately goes over. Once he's analyzed the situation, there's a couple in one car in head-on collision, and they are in relatively good condition, a little shooken up from the accident. But you've got the other guy, as he explained, the driver who was driving this car was now sitting in the back seat, okay, of his car. He had been pushed completely by the motor into the back seat of his car. They airlifted him out. He never even made it to the hospital, I don't think. So, but my brother rushed to the aid of the one who needed the help the most, helping him, and left the others who were okay until the ambulance showed up and just worked on this guy. Okay, and this is what Jesus is doing. He's rushing to those who are on the edge of death, a tax collector, a sinner, and he leaves aside for a moment on the outskirts, the Pharisee, okay? The Pharisee or the scribe, who's not far, as Jesus will say, not far from the kingdom of God. And so this is what he's doing there in this situation, even though unfortunately, the Pharisees don't understand. Verse 18, now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and people came and said to him, why do John's disciples and the disciples of Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? So you can also hear the religious landscape a little bit here. There are multiple movements in Judaism at the time. The most well-known would be the Sadducees and the Pharisees. We know them because they're referred, we hear reference to it all over in the New Testament. There were also the Essenes, we know from reading Josephus. The Essenes were a minor group compared to the Pharisees and Sadducees, but they were significant enough for Josephus to mention them. And in fact, there was an entire section in the city of Jerusalem called the Essene Quarter. This is the place where the upper room was. We discussed this in the Bible study on the Gospel of John. And so he's asked about John's disciples, the disciples of the Pharisees, his own disciples. So you can hear that there's these different religious movements. Judaism is fractured into multiple movements in the first century, all trying to solve the same problem, answer the same question. Why has God not yet returned to his temple? And where is the Messiah? right? They're waiting for the return of two kings, the divine king and the earthly king. And they both seem to be a little late. So for 500 years since the Babylonian exile, the prophets have all been saying, they're coming, they're returning, the Messiah is going to come, God's going to return to his temple. Where are they 500 years later? Come on! And so the Judaism splits up into multiple movements, factions, denominations, that all are trying to answer that question of why God appears to be delayed or why he is delayed or whatever however they interpret in various ways. And so not only now do you have the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Zealots, the Essenes, and who knows how many other minor groups, but also there's this movement that's following John the Baptist, and there's now this movement following Jesus. Now, John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and people came and said to him, "Why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not?" And Jesus said to them, "Can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast." Right? Can you imagine being at a wedding feast, at a wedding reception, and someone comes up, the bride and the bridegroom come up to your table to say hi, and you don't have any food in front of you? And you say, and they say, "Well, aren't you hungry?" "Oh, I am, but I'm fasting today. It's a day of fasting, severe abstinence and fasting." "At our wedding reception?" "Oh, yes, a day of penance for you and the rest of these sinners." Okay, so can you imagine how offended they would be? So at a wedding feast, you participate in the wedding feast, right? So he says, "As long as the bridegroom is with them, they cannot fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day." Okay, they will fast in that day. Now, in that day means that era, right, that period. So once the bridegroom is gone, once Jesus is gone, then they will begin to fast, just like the other religious movements fast. But as long as Jesus is with them, they're not fasting. Okay, so what happens? If you read in the Didache, which is an apostolic document, dated as early by some scholars as AD 70. That's earlier than the writing of John's gospel. And as late as 120, as some scholars would suggest. Whatever date you want to pick, it really doesn't matter. You know, on average, you say just around, right around 100, sometime around the writing of John's gospel. You have a document that is referred to by many later fathers. And then also, of course, today is understood by scholars to be a very important apostolic document. It's not, you know, something from the outskirts of Christianity or something like that. And it's basically a catechetical document. It's the earliest catechism we have. It tells you why we baptize and how we baptize, why we celebrate Lord's Supper and how to do it, and some basic moral directions and things like that. If you've never read the Didache, I highly recommend it to. And by the way, there's also a study of it on the website here on the St. Elias website in the archive of the Bible study page. You can scroll down, you can see the apostolic documents that we studied a while ago, and you can see the Didache there. And the Didache is available. You can buy a copy of it through any online bookseller, or you can just access it digitally now online. So in the Didache, it says that the Christians fasted on Wednesday and Friday. Wednesday and Friday. Okay. The Jews fasted 2 days out of the week as well, as a commemoration of when Moses went up on the mountain and received the law and when he came down. For the Christians, they celebrated a parallel event, a fulfillment of that. And that is when Jesus entered into his passion and when it was done. Okay, and so that was what we would call today Tuesday evening and Thursday evening. Okay, that would be Tuesday evening, Thursday evening. So, but today, that now that begins, of course, Wednesday and Friday for us. If you've ever visited a monastery, you might have been shocked to show up at a monastery and where they're keeping the actual liturgical hours and time with the sunset, because when Friday evening comes, in American calculations, after sunset, if dinner is going to be at 7 o'clock that night, after Vespers, you may be served meat. I lived in a monastery many years ago, and we used to have fun with the visitors when they would show up. They used to come for the weekends, and they'd show up on a Friday, and they knew we were very serious at this monastery. That's why they were coming for a visit. This is a very traditional monastery. And so they'd be with us a whole day working out in the monastery grounds and, you know, hoeing weeds and things like that. And then we would go to Vespers, and then after Vespers, we'd go into the refectory, and on Friday evening, we'd usually have some sort of dish with meat. And it was always fun to watch the visitors as they looked at each other across the table nervously. What is going on here? But we couldn't say anything because it was still the profound silence. We were still listening to the readings while we ate from whatever particular book we were studying at that point, sometimes the Desert Fathers or something. And then usually after halfway into the meal, when the reading was over, the abbot would ring a bell and say, okay, that's enough. Now everyone can just talk, which means now we've entered into the weekend, you know. And so then we would usually explain to the poor visitors who were having a crisis of faith that we had fasted the night before. Okay, so that's all to tell you that on Wednesdays and Fridays, historically, Wednesdays and Fridays, Christians have ordinarily given up something as they're able. Now, if you are sick, you are elderly, or an infant, or whatever, pregnant, of course you have to mitigate these things and work around these things. The point is to do some sort of fasting on Wednesday and Friday, the beginning and the end of Jesus's passion. If you look at John's gospel and many early traditions regarding this, Jesus celebrated the Last Supper, the mystical supper as we call it in the East, on what you and I would call Tuesday night after sunset. That was Passover in the Essene Quarter. And then he died on Friday at around 3 p.m. And so the beginning of the and the end of his passion was Wednesday and Friday. Okay, so this is where you get the Wednesday-Friday fast. From the earliest references in the Didache all the way to today, even on our calendar in the Melkite Eparchy for the United States, if any of you have that calendar, you know on Wednesdays and Fridays you have a fast from what you're able to, from meat and dairy, or if you're having, you know, if you're getting health problems, things have to be mitigated, but that's how it works. Okay, so now, where were we here? Verse 21, no one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, and the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. Now, this is completely lost on modern society. Some of you are old enough to remember these things when we used to patch things. I had a pair of jeans that I had inherited from my older brother, and he had inherited that pair of jeans from his older brother. By the time it got to me, and someone had it before them, I don't know. By the time it got to me, this pair of blue jeans had layers of patches on the knees and on the rear end and other places, okay? My grandmother, she would take old blue jeans that were, you know, falling apart, and she would cut out patch pieces and then toss what was, you know, worthless, and then she would save all that. And so anytime wore a hole in one of our knees of our jeans, which was on a daily basis, she would then take the blue jeans when it was, you know, she'd find it in the wash and look at it. Oh, no. And then once it was dried, she would put a new patch on there and sew it on. But the patch was from old blue jeans that were already shrunk, sewn onto old blue jeans that were already shrunk. Okay? Now, again, some of you will probably remember the old days. I wish I could still find them. And if you know where you could, maybe in Oklahoma. Maybe the Leps can help me find it in Oklahoma. Do you remember when I was a kid, I would go to the store and you would buy blue jeans. This is before the pre-shrunk stuff. Your blue jeans were these pieces of blue cardboard on the shelves. Okay, these almost black. They were so dark blue, they were almost black. And they were folded up like cardboard on the shelves in, you know, Sears and whatever else. I see Joyce shaking her. She remembers those days. Okay, so then you would have to know ahead of time what you wore, because there's no way you could put these things on and figure it out. You'd buy them. I remember my mom used to buy them about 4 inches longer than our ankle. 4 inches. Okay, that was the standard. And then I think in the waist, at least 2 inches, maybe an inch to 2 inches. Because then you brought them home, you put them in the washing machine in hot water, and you washed them and washed them and washed them, usually about 3 washes, and then you put them in the dryer. And then, now they're still pretty dark at that point, they're pretty stiff still, but they would shrink up over the next few months as you'd wear them. Even after a couple washes, we'd still have to roll the pant leg up. But then after a few months, by the time you got to Thanksgiving, right, we used to get our new pants right before school would start. So around Thanksgiving, they were fully shrunk now. And they would – can you imagine putting a new piece of fabric, a new piece of fabric on an old cloth, or even vice versa? Either way, one's going to shrink and the other one's not. And it's going to pull away. It's not going to hold. But you would never do such a thing because the amount of shrinkage as a cloth obviously gets older. So he says, no one does such a thing as this. He says, no one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it. And the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. Again, like I said, today, people say, what's a patch? Okay, what do you mean a patch? If they know what a patch is, they're thinking of those iron-on things. You know, you go to the CVS or something, and they have this, it's not even denim, but it's supposed to look like denim. It's a piece of plasticky stuff, and you iron on over the spot, and it never works. Peels off, worthless. Okay, he says, and no one puts new wine in old wineskins. If he does, the wineskin will burst the skins, and the wine is lost, and so are the skins, but the new wine is for fresh skins. Again, cultural issues here, right? Especially if you're a Baptist reading this. Okay, so you put wine, new wine. New wine is right off the vine, okay? So you take the wine, you take the vine, wine, vine, same word. You take the grapes from the vine, you squish them up, and you take the juice, and you put it into a wineskin. A wineskin is a leather bag. Now, as it begins to ferment, it starts to inflate the bag and stretch the bag and stretch the bag and stretch the bag because of the fermentation. Now, if you take an old wineskin, which is already stretched, let's say a wineskin, a normal wineskin, just a number here. We're going to say a wineskin holds about 1 gallon, okay, and unshrunk. You put your fresh wine, that is your freshly squeezed grape juice in there, and as it's fermenting, the wineskin stretches. But if you now take a stretched wineskin, which has been stretched out to, we'll say, a capacity of maybe, we'll say, 1.5 gallons, and you put fresh wine in there, now it's going to have to stretch further. And, of course, the integrity of the leather will only last so long, and it will burst. And so then you've lost your wine and your wineskin. He says, no, 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 you put new wine in a new wineskin. Again, something far from our culture today. What is he trying to say? The point is that the gospel that he is preaching, the movement that he is beginning, is not to be compared to the old ones, even John the Baptist movement. So the movement of Jesus and his disciples and what they're doing is not to be compared to the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and even John the Baptist movement. Those are of another era. That's a different situation. This is unique. This is unique, he's saying. as different as that unshrunk cloth versus the shrunk cloth, or the wine, the new wine versus old wine, or the new wineskin versus the old wineskin. Okay, something very, it's unique, it's different. The new covenant versus the old. All of those that were referred to here are of the old covenant. This is the new covenant, this beginning. Verse 23. One Sabbath, he was going through the grain fields. And as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck ears of grain. This is Mark chapter 2, verse 23. Mark chapter 2, verse 23. One Sabbath, he was going through the grain fields, and as they made their way, his disciples began to pluck ears of grain. And the Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" Okay, now some of you have probably done this, especially our Oklahomian friends there. They've done these. I remember as a kid in Paso Robles, Alejandro, you did this, I'm sure. In Paso Robles, when we used to walk through the barley fields, we were out hunting. One of the things we would do is pluck a head of barley. And you take the head of barley and you roll it in your hand, and all the little pieces come apart, and then you end up with a pile of the little barley berries, if you want to call it that, or whatever, the barley grains, the little hard things, like little pieces of rice, and then the little husks. And you go, and you blow off all the husks, and you end up in your hand, if you don't blow too hard, with a few of these little barley berries. And then you throw them in your mouth, and you eat them. Now, this is not, you know, a five-course meal here, okay? And you chew too hard, you're going to break a tooth. So you're chewing on these very hard little barley berries, these grains, and you got to chew very slowly and carefully lest you break a tooth. And you kind of gnaw on them for a while, and you can get a little sustenance from it. You are not going to fill your belly this way, okay? You would starve to death if you had to eat this way. But this is what they're doing. They're walking through a grain field, and they're hungry. And so they're plucking a head of grain or two and rolling their hand and eating it. By the time they got through this field, there's no way. Let's say 12 guys, Jesus with the 12 apostles, you know, walking through a grain field, there's no way they would have pulled more than, you know, maybe 24 or 36 heads of grain. These aren't big grain field, you know, grain fields. So we're not talking about a lot of barley here being harvested. But they accuse him and his disciples of doing something that is unlawful, that is contrary to the Torah. Contrary to the Torah. Well, if you go look in the book of Deuteronomy, you will not find anywhere where God forbids people from plucking grain and eating it. What you will find in Deuteronomy is a commandment: you cannot put your sickle to the grain on the Sabbath. Now, the sickle is for harvesting. You go out into the field with your sickle and you swing it, and you take a swath of barley and you gather, as you swath it, you gather it in your arm, and then you gather it in a bunch of these like this, and eventually you have a whole sheave bundled together, okay? This is harvesting, modern day John Deere tractor, okay? This is harvesting the field. This is not plucking grain so that you don't starve to death. The first commandment about Sabbath is in Exodus chapter 12. It's the very first reference to the idea of a Sabbath rest. In that case, it's not even a Saturday Sabbath. It's a great Sabbath. That is a Sabbath, the first day of a festal period. So the first day of the festal period of the Sabbath, or that is the week-long feast of unleavened bread, was a Sabbath, day of rest. And God says to them, this is in Exodus chapter 12, "You shall do no work on that day, but you, of course, do what you need to do to prepare food." Okay, so God is not telling them, don't breathe on the Sabbath, don't move on the Sabbath. But what he's telling them is, don't go out on the Sabbath and do the things you normally do. All the other days you go out and harvest your grain, or you go out and do your work. On the Sabbath, a special day, Saturday each week, or the first or last day of a festal period, was to be a holy day, a special day, set apart. Holy means distinct, set apart. If you think back to Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, God says, or the author there tells us that God rested on the Sabbath and he hallowed it, as you have in most English translations. He sanctified it in a modern English translation. He hallowed it, sanctified. He caused it to be holy, sanctified, set apart, because on that day he did not work. So that works. So all the other days he was working, doing stuff. That day he stopped working. That's how he sanctified it, by doing something else compared to what he was doing on the other days. Okay, so those other days he's working, this day he stops working. The fact that he stops working is the sanctification of the day. That's what makes it unique. And so the same thing, Christians have always, of course, tried to keep as best as we're able this, the day of the resurrection, as our holy day, our special holy day, the day of the resurrection, and any other special holy day, especially in Christian culture, if you go back a century ago, any major feast day was a day when you got off work. You didn't go to work. Okay, so it didn't matter what day of the week it fell on. The birth of our Lord, Christmas. Okay, you go downtown, no stores will be open. Everybody's home with their families or at church. So a Sabbath, a day of rest in the Christian tradition, the first day of the week, that is the resurrection of Jesus, that's our weekly special feast day, and then any particular major feast day, of course, is for Abel. So these Pharisees accuse Jesus of breaking the Torah, but he hasn't broken the Torah. He and his disciples have not broken the Torah. The law even says specifically, you may do what you need to do that is required to eat something on that day. Again, you can go see that in Exodus chapter 12. But Jesus says, have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry? So it's a good thing it's Jesus here. If I was there, I just would have argued with them on the spot about the whole thing. You're not quoting the text properly. That's not what the text says. Let's go back and look at Deuteronomy. You see, you have no foundation for your argument. Thank God I'm not Jesus. Okay, so what Jesus does is he uses it as an opportunity of catechesis. Instead of just proving them wrong, instead of just arguing with them and showing them that they're improperly interpreting the text of Deuteronomy, instead what he does, he uses an opportunity to correct them, but also as a vehicle of catechesis. So what he does, he says this, he says, have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry? He and those who were with him. So right off the bat, parallelism, right? Between David and those and his men, and Jesus and his men, right? So there's already some catechesis there. Jesus, the new David, the Messiah. How he entered the house of God when Abiathar was high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful for any but the priest to eat, and also gave it to those who were with him. So you can read about this in the First Samuel, the story of how David is fleeing from Saul, and he goes to the high priest and to the meeting tent, which at that point was probably at Shiloh, I can't remember. And then he asks for food, and the high priest says, "Oh, we don't have any, except for the bread of the presence. I mean, the bread that's offered to God, and they change that out each week. So that's all we got. You can have that." So David and his men eat that food, he says, which is not lawful for any but the priest to eat. And he also gave to those who were with him. What's that about? Well, we've talked about this before. David is given that food, but he's not just your run-of-the-mill guy walking by the sanctuary. David is the anointed king of Israel. The anointed king of Israel, right? God has chosen him for a special purpose, and he needs this food, and the high priest give it to him. And so this is, again, some catechesis about who is this Jesus. Jesus is the son of David, descendant of David. He's like David. His men are like David's men. And he was allowed to do things that were beyond what you would normally expect in the Torah and the Old Testament. Okay? So look what he says here now. He says, and he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Okay, so this is the beginning of some very important catechesis that Jesus will give his disciples and those following him about the old law. All of the laws of the Old Testament, what you could and could not eat, who was to enter into what place and not enter another place, who was to marry whom, who was whatever, all of the laws, 365 laws in the Old Testament, depending on how you want to count them, all of them were for one purpose. It can be summarized in two very simple commandments. Love God with your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole self, your whole being, and your neighbor as yourself. Now, love God, love the Lord your God, as you hear it in the New Testament when Jesus answers the question, what is the greatest commandment? Jesus says this. And when Jesus asks, throws the question back at lawyers, they say the same thing. Love God with your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole self, and your neighbor as yourself. Now, the Lord God, love the Lord God. If you go back and look, that text is a quote from Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4 and following. This is one of the most sacred texts of the Torah. In fact, it's so sacred that a pious Jew even today says this every morning when he wakes up and every night when he goes to bed. Deuteronomy 6, 4. Okay? Love the Lord. Now, the word Lord there is a Greek circumlocution for the divine name in the original text. Love Yahweh, your God. This is a monotheistic statement. That is, love Yahweh, your God, with your whole heart, not with part of your heart. Your whole soul, not part of your strength. Your whole strength, not part of your strength. That is, don't be a stinking pagan polytheist and worship other gods along with Yahweh. You have to worship him alone. And don't forget to love your neighbors yourself. This is Leviticus 19. Why? Well, it's the same commandment in the end. It's related. Your neighbor is made the image likeness of God, right? This is Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, 28. So, in the end, really, love of neighbor and love of the one true God, it's all the same. And that's the whole purpose of the Law and the Prophets, Jesus. The Law and the Prophets is all summarized in this. Love God and your neighbors yourself. Right? The whole purpose, the law against bacon, the law about leprosy, the law about blood, the law about you name it, was all, Jesus said, it's all fulfilled. Every one of those little laws you can think of, whatever, is all fulfilled in two commandments. Love God and neighbors yourself. That's the purpose of it all. And so if you've loved God with your whole heart, your whole mind, and your neighbor yourself, you can have bacon. Just don't have too much. Okay? So you can have bacon. This is, God doesn't have any problem with ham sandwiches. What he has a problem with is the Israelites eating ham sandwiches with the Canaanite neighbor, and then their kids having ham sandwiches together. And before you know it, the Israelite son is going to get married off to the Canaanite girl, neighbor girl, while they're having their ham sandwiches. And before you know it, the Israeli son is going to be worshiping the gods of the Canaanites. These were cultural barriers, hedges, that kept Israel separate from their pagan neighbors around them. Not because God has any problem with the pagan neighbors around them, in whom they were. It was what they were doing. The whole purpose of the call of Israel was the same as the call of their great ancestor, Abraham. So that through Abraham, or through his seed, Israel, all the nations could be blessed. It was through the monotheism that Israel was to live out that the pagan polytheists around them were to eventually come in to the true faith. Okay, so whether we're talking about a Sabbath law or we're talking about about eating bread or whose bread or whatever, all of this was intended for that purpose. Even the Sabbath law. Man was not made for the Sabbath. But the Sabbath was made for man, for man's sake. Okay. That's probably a good spot to stop. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and into age of ages. Amen.